When do you need to form an LLC for your film, and how long do you need to keep it? AI, where are we currently at with all the legal clearances? What do you need to do to protect yourself for your documentary? If you have multiple producers on a film, should you have multiple lawyers to protect each, or is one enough? These are a few of the questions that we'll answer and more on this episode of Ask an Entertainment Lawyer with entertainment lawyer and filmmaker Chris Edgar.
This is the Working Director Podcast, show that helps you go from emerging filmmaker to working director. As a filmmaker living in Los Angeles, I've directed over 130 projects, including 6 distributed feature films, all while helping filmmakers figure out how to level up in their careers. I do this show with one goal in mind: to help you become a working director. And if you want to join us for the live Q&A sessions and ask all of your questions, make sure you join our free private Facebook group by going to theworkingdirector.pro.
Chris and I are in the producer's lab right now, the Black Magic Collective producer's lab, and we are learning way more than my brain can handle about everything from how to finance your film to, you know, for pitch decks and getting in the room and finding investors and all the legal things that go around it. And I keep looking to Chris during the class going, "You're getting this right? Okay, great." Because I don't get half of it. But while we were going to put questions in, Chris, I would love to talk about briefly one thing that's kind of come up, which is deliverables. We've been asked step by several members even to cover deliverables. And as I've told them in the emails back, we can't really do that in a half hour. That's its own separate show. But if you could kind of give the overall view of what people need to think about in order to distribute their film.
Okay, yeah, we're talking about deliverables that will be asked of you by your distributor. They're going to have this long list that's going to be part of the contract that they give to you. And yeah, hopefully answering this question is going to help that list be a little bit less shocking to see, because it is a long list for people who see it the first time. So from a legal perspective, you're going to need things like a copyright certificate. There's going to be a restriction on credits. You'll need to provide a summary of any kind of contract provisions that you may have with your cast, saying I have to be credited using my own separate title card or something of that nature. Any kind of restrictions on advertising that you may have signed with any of the cast members. So for instance, a cast member might say, if there's going to be a poster, my image must be no smaller than that of any other cast member who's on the poster. So you'll need to provide a document that summarizes those kinds of provisions. You'll probably have to provide what's called a chain of title affidavit. You know, I can't go through the entire list because then that would take the whole episode, but I'm just giving you some examples. And feel free to hit me up if you want to talk about, you know, a more comprehensive discussion of what these lists are going to include. But there's a chain of title affidavit which lists, it summarizes basically all of the contracts that have to do with your production. From your contracts with your talent to the option agreement or the acquisition agreement that you use to get the rights to make a film based on the screenplay, to your copyright certificate. And it's just going to be a summary of everything. And you're also going to be providing those documents to the distributor, which is something that you should think about. Like if you are missing a contract with a cast or a crew member, for instance, then it's going to be a lot more efficient for you to get that signed now than, you know, trying to scramble to do it by the distributor's deadline once you actually enter into one of these distribution agreements.
Yeah, I would say that the best way to think about deliverables is it's to cover your ass. Like if there's anything you touch, anything that's on screen, any vendor you've used, anything at all, just have contracts for everything from pre-production through post-production. And there's more to it, because I know that, like, Chris, you had to provide a whole music cue sheet. There's all kinds of things. Matter of fact, how about for those of you watching, I have a very comprehensive deliverables list. If you email info@blackmagiccollective.com or go in the Working Director Facebook group and you want this list, I will get it to you. And that way you'll have it. Liam asks, if I rent artwork as set dressing from a prop house, do I need an art release from the prop house, or is the vendor contract enough?
If you're going to be using artwork, I would always get a release from all of the parties who were involved. Particularly, I would check to see if your vendor contract has some sort of release provision in there. That would be the first step. I would also approach the prop house if you can and get them to sign a very simple one-page release form that just says that you have the right to use the art for any and all purposes in your film.
And does that then kind of make it go back on them if an artist came after the filmmaker? They'd be like, hey, you got to go to the prop house. They released it.
Well, that's a good point. And that's why sometimes it's a good idea to include an agreement, what's called an indemnification clause. Like, for instance, you're buying the right to a screenplay. then it's a good idea to have the screenwriter sign a clause saying that if someone sues you, the production company, for some sort of copyright violation, like if they claim that the screenwriter plagiarized somebody else's work, for instance, then the screenwriter is going to have to pay any legal fees that come up rather than you as the production company, because they promised you that this you'd be getting this script free and clear of any kind of possible legal claims.
Next question, Anthony Short. Are finder's agreements a good idea for financing? Are there limitations or concerns when it comes to SEC rules or regulations with these agreements?
There are restrictions on anyone who is not a broker-dealer or a licensed broker-dealer with the SEC accepting any kind of payments in connection with the sale of securities. This is kind of a specialized area, so I would need to look up the specific regulations that we're talking about here. But if we're talking about the sale of securities and the sale of units in an LLC or shares in a corporation can qualify as sales of securities, then sometimes there are restrictions on someone who's not a licensed broker-dealer accepting payments. And that's the kind of thing where you really, where bringing an attorney in is critical for your production. I'd be happy actually to take a deeper look at that subject if you would like, if you want to hit me up about that.
Yeah, because especially I think financing, I think that once you know, it's one thing if you're doing like a $250,000 film, but you're getting the million dollars films,
yep.
Like you should have an entertainment lawyer on your team. I'm just lucky that Chris is an entertainment lawyer. So when we produce films, he's always there. Next question. MB, do you recommend starting an LLC for your film before you have funding secured and are just acquiring costs related to the starting up, equipment, baseline contract, et cetera?
Yeah, I would. I mean, I know you got to pay the franchise tax and an initial fee and so forth to the state, but I would recommend creating the LLC that's specific to the film as soon as possible. And one reason, I mean, not even having to do with the law, but is optics. That someone who is interested in writing you a check for your film is not going to want to write a check to you individually. They're going to prefer to write a check to an LLC or some other kind of business entity, which, if you have one of those, it shows that you're a legitimate production and you've jumped through the legal hoops that you need to create a company for your film. If you don't have an LLC yet, there aren't really that many agreements that you could enter into. I wouldn't recommend entering into an agreement with an investor who is agreeing to pay you money. And you presumably aren't interested in hiring producers and actors and so forth individually, right? If you are working with other collaborators on the film at this point, like you have co-producers, then even if you don't have a company yet, it can still be to your advantage to sign a collaboration agreement that basically just says, okay, this person's going to be a producer, this person's the writer-director, and so on. And they're going to get these credits when it eventually comes time to make the film. And that the purpose of that is just to make sure that, no one's going to get cut out of the deal after doing some work to promote and finance the film and so on.
I have slightly two takes on this as a non-lawyer, but as somebody who's done plenty of LLCs. One, you don't have to pay your franchise tax board for the first year. So you could get a film LLC, and if the film doesn't go in that first year, which if it doesn't go in that first year, if you're not getting funding that first year, you should probably move on anyway. You can close it without owing any money. The flip side of that is if you're just browsing, you're just looking at what's out there, you're not sure you're going to make it, you don't even have a pitch deck ready, I personally wouldn't get the LLC yet. I would wait until I'm ready to go out and get financing. I know Chris and I we differ on that opinion.
Well, if there's a script involved and you need to acquire the right to a script, then you're definitely going to need to have a company.
That's why I feel like people, individuals like MB, if you are an individual producer, filmmaker, you should have an LLC. And I say even further, as an S-Corp election anyway. So when people are paying you to direct or produce whatever your job is, you can write off so much more and they can pay your company instead of you so you don't get taxed. And at the end of the year, you'll make less to the government because you can deduct so much. So to Chris's point, then you can just option a script to your company. And then later, unless I'm wrong, Chris, later she could then move that option to the film LLC, correct?
Yeah, you could acquire an option individually in a script. Or if you have a loan out company, that could acquire the option. And then you could write up what's called an assignment agreement, which just assigns the film rights or the right to make a film based on the screenplay to the production company that's specific to the film.
Funny. So Kay's asking, which is kind of what we were digging into just now, what's the benefit of creating an LLC for the film versus for you as a filmmaker? And that's the biggest difference is as you create one for as you as a filmmaker, again, you can use this from now for the next 40 years of your career, that one LLC. Then when you do a feature film, I don't recommend them for short films unless you're raising a lot of money. For feature films, then you make those, because that way, as Chris has taught me over and over again and drilled into me, you're not going to be liable yourself. You're not going to be able to lose, say, K. Laray LLC, because everything, all the lawsuits or anything bad or whatever would go towards the film LLC.
Yes. And you could make your loan out company one of the owners of the film LLC. There's a lot of flexibility as far as how you can arrange the ownership. But that's the main advantage of having an LLC that's specific to the film, is that if someone decides to sue, like if there's a caterer who claims that you didn't pay enough for the fajitas or something that they made, then they can't go after your assets individually or the assets of your loan out company. They're going to be restricted to going after the assets of your film LLC.
Yeah, this is something I preach to all of the working director group. I'm constantly telling them you need to get even a DBA. Even if you're a newer filmmaker and you're not making a lot of money, you should still go get a DBA and do business as, and do your, have a separate bank account and do a Schedule C, all that good stuff. So we have one more LLC question. And Maurice says, if we have an LLC for the production company, could we classify it as a DBA?
You can have an LLC that's called you know, X LLC or Johnson Productions LLC, and you could then create a doing business as alias for it. So if your film is called, you know, Star Tours or something like that, then you could have Johnson Productions LLC doing business as Star Tours, and you could identify yourself as Star Tours to the public.
Martin, I see your question. I'm going to come back to it when we get more LLC, after these LLC questions. Liam's asking, since I have to supply E&O insurance to the distributor, do I have to keep the film's LLC entity active during the term of the E&O policy, or can I dissolve the LLC? This is actually a hot question, because I'm always like, when can you dissolve that film LLC so you're not continuing to pay on it?
Yeah, unfortunately, you do have to keep the LLC active during the term, during the life of the policy. In fact, there probably is a clause in your insurance policy that says that if the entity that has acquired this policy goes out of business or declares bankruptcy or something like that, then this policy is going to be canceled. That would be a relatively common clause. So yeah, I would look out for that, but the safest bet is to keep your company active during the life of the policy.
On that note, knock on wood, I think only once have we had to pay E&O insurance ourselves. The distributor has almost always covered that. And I believe, like, once your film isn't making you any money anymore, which, you know, God willing, you're making money for 10 years, but if you're not making the money to cover that $800 a year, I would close the LLC personally. Chris may not agree with me legally.
It depends on whether you think there's any risk that you're going to have to use the E&O policy. Also, your distributor is going to want you to keep the E&O policy in place. So there probably is a clause in your distribution agreement that says that the policy has to be in force for a particular period of time. And so if you canceling the LLC would result in that policy being canceled, then you would end up breaching your contract with your distributor, which is a risk that you don't want to take, I guess, unless all you're doing is spending money and making no money. Maybe it's a risk you want to take in that situation, and you want to listen to Jen in under those circumstances.
The other question that goes along with this is, can you just do the E&O insurance under your production company? That way you can close the film's LLC, but keep the E&O insurance alive.
The E&O policies are usually issued for specific films. So you'll get a long questionnaire when you're applying for E&O insurance that will ask you about all of these attributes of the film, like what's the plot, and you need to give us a script clearance report that talks about all the possible legal issues that come up. And like, for instance, if the script says that somebody's wearing Adidas shoes or something like that, it has to flag the fact that, oh, Adidas might come after you for some sort of trademark violation and so forth. So unfortunately, the E&O policy is specific to each film.
And the final thought on that, or just a comment on that, is our last film, we made it on like no money. So we didn't do an LLC for the feature. We put it all under my production company, my and Chris production company. So everything is under that. So it's just kind of living. There's not a lot of risk involved with the film we made, but I think moving forward, I would want to be a little more conscious of that.
Yeah. And you can do it with production insurance, by the way. You can have production insurance under your sort of umbrella LLC. It doesn't need to be specific to your film, because that just covers, you know, any sort of accidents and injuries that might happen on set. But E&O has to do with essentially you being sued based on some alleged intellectual property violation based on the contents of the film, or for defamation or a similar claim like that.
All right. I'm going to go to this topic from Martin, although I'll read it first and I'll make my comment and then I'll give it to Chris. But So Martin says, hot topic, and speaking of legal claims, AI and authorship. Have you got into or heard of any issues, concerns in this evolving technology regarding clearances? And Martin, we did last month, we really deep dived into this as much as we could on the Ask a Lawyer thing, but Chris can give you the quick answer now.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, like you say, this is an evolving area of the law. There have been a lot of lawsuits filed by people who are disgruntled by the use of their copyrighted works to train AIs, for instance. And the courts have not yet ruled on whether using, it's a book by Sarah Silverman, actually. She's one of the plaintiffs in these cases. And then Michael Chabon, the well-known novelist, they've sued OpenAI, claiming that using their copyrighted books to train the AI is itself a copyright violation. The courts have yet to rule on that, but if that comes down in favor of Silverman and Chabon, then the way that these AIs operate, that is the way that they train, they get trained in the way that they render answers and so forth, is probably gonna have to be completely revamped. So yeah, right now there's a lot of uncertainty. Another point that we know at this point, although it hasn't been ruled on by the Supreme Court at this point, it's just at the level of the US Copyright Office and a couple of trial courts, is that a work that's created entirely by AI is not considered to have an author, and therefore it's not considered to be copyrighted. So people have created graphic novels and pieces of art and so forth, basically giving a text-based prompt to an AI, and the AI has done the rest. And the Copyright Office has said, you need a certain amount of human creativity involved in the process. So a piece of art that's just generated by AI can't be copyrighted. That's going to have interesting consequences that will reverberate throughout the industry in ways that we haven't necessarily seen yet. But yeah, I guess the takeaway from that is, if you generate some art using AI, then don't release that by itself, right? If you create art using AI and you incorporate that into a film that you've written a script for and directed and so forth, then you're on much more solid ground. Then you can copyright, even if you can't copyright the individual pieces of art that were created by AI, you could still clearly get a copyright in your film as a whole. So I hope that sort of touched on what the trendiest issues in the law are as far as AI is concerned, but I'm sure that didn't necessarily even scratch the surface as far as all the potential issues that might come up.
Yeah, it'll be evolving for quite some time. I'm curious to see what happens with the WGA and what they agreed to and how they worked that out in their contracts as well. Maurice says, if we do general liability and E&O under production company rather than film entity, do we have to maintain a long-term policy rather than that for the span of the filmmaking?
For general liability insurance policies, those are tied to the production company, usually. And that's just something that you can keep paying premiums on year after year, which I think, Jen, is what you do with Heart on Fire, right? You just have a production.
I do, except I have a very basic, what's called DICE policy, and it's basically for commercials and short videos. Yes. So if you're doing a feature film, technically you're supposed to get its own policy anyway. So you might as well put it up to the film's LLC.
Yeah, that's true. And for E&O insurance, then that's going to, like I was saying, that has to be specific to the film. And your distributor is going to have requirements in the contract that they sign with you about what that policy is going to need to be contained, what going to need to contain. Like, it'll usually need to be at least 3 years. It'll need to have to cover $2 million per occurrence and up to $3 million per year in liability and so forth. And you'll need to name the distribution company on the policy. So those requirements will be specific to each film, and you'll need to get a separate E&O policy when it comes to each film that you're getting distributed.
Kay asks, what are the basic legalities around copyrighted material for documentary projects? Is there anything different from what you mentioned before?
In documentaries, there's going to be a lot more focus typically on what's called fair use, which is a copyright doctrine that says that even if the use of, say, a copyrighted photo or clip would be copyright infringement under ordinary circumstances, in some situations, you can still do it. It's still legal. There are some factors that courts consider in determining whether the use of a copyrighted work is fair use. One of them is whether the use is transformative, and that's something that comes into play in documentaries a lot. Like, for instance, if you're doing an interview with somebody and let's say they're talking about true crime thing and they're talking about a murder that they witnessed. And so while they're giving the interview, then you're showing, you know, these police line shots, or you're showing police photographs in the background and so on. Or perhaps, let's say, copyrighted news clips. In that situation, your use of the news clip is likely to be considered transformative because it's being used to give context to the interview that the person is giving, which is, it gives it a purpose that it didn't initially have when the news company filmed it. In the context of, did you ask about insurance? No, just the legalities around copyright material. Yeah, So you're going to need to keep a pretty comprehensive log of all of the copyrighted photos and clips that you want to use so that you can tell your distributor and your insurer about them. And you may need to have a lawyer write a letter saying, I believe that the fair use doctrine that I just talked about protects my unlicensed use of these images and clips. But the use of unlicensed images and clips is very common in the context of documentaries, particularly when you're showing footage in the background of an interview that somebody's giving.
Liam says, is a property release needed for locations, or is a location agreement enough?
Your location agreement is usually going to contain a release. It'll say that the owner of the location releases you from, well, for one thing, any kind of claims of intellectual property violations. Like if you happen to use a logo, or you happen to use, you get footage of the exterior of the building or something like that, they can't come back and claim that they had some sort of right of publicity or trademark or something like that that you violated by filming there. So there's going to be a release to that extent. If you're talking about a release when it comes to the people who you observe there, who you know end up in the shots and so forth, if you're in a public place, usually that's not a concern because people aren't considered to have an expectation of privacy when they're in a public place. If you were brought inside some sort of corporate office where the public is not usually invited, then it would be a good idea for people who might end up in your footage to sign releases saying that they release you from any kind of right of publicity or invasion of privacy claim that they might otherwise be able to make against you based on their appearance in your film.
David, how many lawyers should we have on a film with multiple producers? Should the producer have a lawyer representing their interests in addition to a lawyer with the interests of the film in mind?
It really depends on how much money is at stake, I would say. If we're talking about a film where, you know, it's a $10 million film or something of that nature, then I would recommend that every producer have their own legal counsel who can evaluate all of the agreements that they're being asked to sign. There are some situations where there's so little money involved in the budget. Like I've been dealing with some of these situations lately myself in terms of representing clients where, you know, you've got three or four people who work together really closely and they all trust each other and they believe it's more efficient to just have them all hire one lawyer to prepare a collaboration agreement between them, as opposed to each of them getting their own lawyer, for the purposes of a production that's not even going to be a $1 million budget. Because if you're going to pay the hourly fee for each lawyer, you multiply that by the number of producers, the legal fees, relative to the budget, are just going to end up being massive.
I also think that, you know, like we're really lucky because Chris is one of the most honest, above board dudes, like in an annoying way. I'm like, can't we just bend this a little bit? So if he's your lawyer, you're safe. But if you're not sure about someone, I would always get someone to protect you and look over your stuff individually. Tanya, in True Crime Docs, what's advisable in use of names of individuals who were minors at the time, but now adults?
If they're now adults, then they should be able to consent to your use of the footage that you took of them when they were minors. I think to be safe, if you wanted to be as conservative as possible, I would acknowledge in the release form that you sign with them that they were minors at the time that this footage was taken. And in full recognition of that, they are still consenting to your use of the footage.
Do you have to get the consent of somebody you're talking about in a true crime doc? Because life rights aren't copywritten, right? Like they can't.
What you'll need to be most worried about in the context of a true crime documentary would be claims like defamation, where someone says, you know, your film made a false statement about me and that damaged my reputation. It's always best if you can get a release from someone saying, I release you from any potential claims of defamation based on your discussion of me in this film. But if you can't get that, then it's going to come down to whether you did your due diligence. In other words, I mean, even if what you say about a person is wrong, the question a court is going to ask is, did you dot your I's and cross your T's as far as doing the factual research regarding what actually happened? And if you did, even if you ultimately came to the wrong conclusion, then a court is likely to let you off the hook in the context of somebody claiming that you made a false statement about
them. I think it always goes back to, did your lawyer make sure all of your contracts were in place? And if you talk to a lawyer and made sure you're safe, like I think when it comes to docs, especially, you put your life in it. I mean, like a 30-minute doc can take you a year to make. So really make sure you're protected. We are out of time. You guys have had amazing questions. I will save my question for next month. We are going to do one more of these this year with Chris, and it'll be next month. You guys have been awesome.
Thanks for listening to the Working Director Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, please rate and review as it helps others find the show and helps us keep making great content for you. And if you want even more help with your directing career, check out theworkingdirector.pro, where you can apply to be part of the accelerator that hones in on where you currently are and helps you get to where you want to be. Whether it's this podcast, the accelerator, or our free Facebook community for directors, we're here to help you get to work.